And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The trouble with being right these days is that it seems the lessons are so hard to learn. Case in point, British Petroleum, otherwise known as BP, that green oil company that controls all of our oil coming to us from Alaska, just turned off the spigot. Seems the pipes are corroded. So this just goes to show you that they were wrong when they promised us the pipeline was guaranteed safe. Remember? It's time we never forget. And Wolverines and the tug of war for some little electric cars, it's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In Pasadena, California this week, there's a standoff that should be a movie. Seems Nissan Motor Company invented some little electric cars, which they leased to the city, and now they want them back. And Pasadena says, hey, not so fast. Sound familiar? No, it's not a review of the movie, it's the real thing. We interview Pasadena's mayor in our first segment. Then, it's up to Alaska, as we take a walk on the wild side of Wolverines, with the Jane Goodall of Gulo Gulo, Wolverines, one of the world's most elusive and least studied large mammals. And then in segment three, it's BP, British Petroleum's sudden whack to their good friend and ally, the U.S., which translates as us. What is going on? We'll find out as we launch another great edition of your Voice of the Earth. But first, the news. The fallout from the sudden shutdown of the Alaska oil pipeline by British Petroleum is still being sorted out, following reports from field workers of yet another oil spill along the pipeline and fears that the extensive corrosion bringing on the ruptures could result in a potential catastrophic spill. BP began a 5-day shutdown of the oil, which represents 8% of U.S. oil consumption. BP states that the closure is expected to last 2 months, during which sections of the pipeline will be replaced. As yet, the full impact of the oil shutdown has not been reflected in higher oil prices, although some analysts predict the possibility of $100 per barrel prices if the shortage continues for too long. West Coast refineries, which process about 2.7 million barrels per day of oil, will be most affected by the oil fields shutdown. But the full impact of the supply cut is not likely to be felt for about 2 weeks, analysts say. Mexico and Saudi Arabia are discussing increasing production to make up for the shortfall. We'll be covering more on this story during segment three of today's show. About 2,000 residents from both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border have been evacuated around El Paso, Texas, as heavy rains threaten the stability of a nearby dam in Mexico, which would cause flooding in the area. If the dam ruptures, its waters would rush into the neighborhoods in South El Paso and North Juarez. Fully 25% of the evacuees retreated to El Paso's convention center. The heavy rains that have brought on this crisis come as a relief to the area, which has been suffering from an extended drought, as barely 1 inch of rain has fallen since the first of the year. The U.S. Air Force is using its weather tracking planes to take a closer look at a strong tropical wave heading into the Windward Islands and moving 20 to 25 miles per hour. The wave has not yet formed into a tropical storm, which would impact the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico in the next few days. Forecasters cannot say whether the storm may head into the Gulf of Mexico. Fear of Gulf hurricanes, which could disrupt U.S. oil and natural gas production, add fear to the existing shortfall due to the Alaskan oil pipeline shutdown. If the storm matures, it will be called Debbie. As the full moon looms in the evening sky, residents in the Philippines have been evacuating around the active volcano Mount Mayan in the province of Albay, as legend and science combine to warn residents that full moons often add enough extra pull on the Earth's crust to bring on a full eruption. It's a sign of the times, as Inuit people in a village of 2,000 in northern Quebec, Canada, are installing air conditioners in this area that for centuries was known for its igloos. But with the general rise in temperatures that seem to be more pronounced in the very northern climes, temperatures have reached as high as 88 degrees in July. The Inuit build airtight houses to keep out the cold, which works against them when they want to create circulation. Peoples around the world are having to literally change their cultural and traditional ways to accommodate the changing weather patterns, not to mention how they will generate the extra money needed to pay the electric bills. And that's the news. So now we're off to the home of the Rose Bowl, the romantic LA community of Pasadena, where a strange story unfolds. Well, one of the hottest movies out there right now, believe it or not, is Who Killed the Electric Car? It's making a lot of news, and as BP is shutting down oil to the United States, these issues about our gas prices and the energy future of America is really hitting us right upside the head. And so this issue of the electric cars is becoming very exciting, and a couple of weeks ago I even got test driving the Tesla electric car, which is an amazing machine. But, you know, electric cars have been around for a while, and that's what makes this particular next story very important. Joining us from Pasadena is the mayor of Pasadena, Bill Bolgard. Bill, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Sydney, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks. Well, interestingly enough, your timing in terms of this particular story couldn't be better because it's so much a focus, electric cars, and the city of Pasadena finds itself right in the middle of a tangle right now concerning some of these early electric versions, electric cars. Why don't you give us a history on that?
I'd be delighted. Pasadena for the last couple of years has been using a fleet of experimental electric vehicles manufactured by Nissan under a lease arrangement where we expected at the conclusion of the lease to be able either to extend or to purchase the vehicles if they proved to be satisfactory. They've worked very well, being used by our municipal utility employees, the employees down at the Rose Bowl, and some of the staff members at Art Center College of Design, which is conducting studies of automobile and transit and what the future holds in terms of automobile and other kinds of transit vehicles. We want to keep these vehicles in Pasadena as part of our ongoing commitment to sustainable practices and policies for our community. Nissan has until now indicated that they must have the vehicles back. They have a significant liability associated with these vehicles because of disposal responsibilities involved in electric batteries. And Pasadena has decided, with the help of Plug In America, the organization that has been raising the issue of whether electric vehicles are being suppressed in our economy, because they will ultimately compete, perhaps effectively, with gasoline-powered vehicles. And we're wanting to take a stand on this and see if there isn't a way in which Nissan can come to agreement with Pasadena to continue to make these vehicles available either by lease or by purchase.
Now, you did sign a contract, and I know that you're having that reviewed by your staff now, the contract, to see if this opportunity for you to either somehow manage to keep them yourself if you found them desirable. Have you determined if that's in your contract at this point?
I don't have the results of our city attorney review of the lease at this point. I would think we'll complete that review this week. Meanwhile, we're making certain that the vehicles are not removed from city property as the matter is evaluated.
Well, what's interesting is the fact that there was a bit of a, I won't call it a standoff because I don't want to be provocative, and I don't think you do either. I know you don't. But apparently Nissan had determined that it was time to pick up the cars. And some trucks appeared. I don't even know if you were informed that they were going to be coming to do this, but give us an update on this. This just happened in the last couple of days.
Well, it did, and the history was that on Monday evening at our regular council meeting, a representative, one of the co-founders of Plug-in America, appeared before the council in a session which is not only public but broadcast to the community through cable television. They offered to assist the city in this effort in promoting public awareness widely of what was going on and seeing if that wouldn't have an impact on Nissan's thinking. The very next morning, representatives of Nissan showed up at the city yards to pick up these vehicles, which had been waiting for pickup over a number of months. No prior notice to the city was provided about this, but good fortune occurred because there was no direct access to the vehicles available. That there were other cars parked around, and when they were our staff people were asked to move the cars, they immediately checked with the city manager's office, who said, well, we wouldn't be releasing these vehicles until our review of the lease has been complete.
Well, that sounds like a moment right out of a movie.
We've got a plot line going.
Well, there is. I mean, I'm trying to visualize this because you have these. I mean, typically the guys that come to pick up cars, they come with big trucks and they're ready to just take them away. That's their mission. But at the same time, I can see where a city employee suddenly goes, wait a second, who are these people and why are they taking these cars? It's my job to make sure that that we follow procedures. And it sounds like that sort of is kind of where the forces met, okay?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful that the council had the opportunity to hear about Plug-in America's offer to work with the city the night before, because when that occurred, it was clear to me as chair of the meeting that there was a good deal of interest among council members. And since then, council members have been quoted in news reports as saying, yes, Pasadena intends to be a progressive city. We intend to be committed to green, sustainable policies, and we want these vehicles to be a part of that program.
How are you communicating? Who are you communicating with at Nissan, and how are your discussions progressing?
To my knowledge, there has been no communication directly between the city and Nissan since Monday evening or in recent weeks, including since Monday evening when this question got raised publicly at our weekly meeting, as I mentioned. As far as the city is concerned, I think we'll complete our review of the lease. We'll talk a little bit with Plug-in America about what kind of a program they might want to suggest to the city to create more public awareness of this. And then the third step, and it would be soon, would be to have some communication initiated by the city with Nissan indicating to them what we would like to do.
You like these cars. The city likes these cars. You have every reason to want to keep them. So what is standing in the way? Why? I understand kind of the liabilities and things that Nissan has to protect themselves legally as well. But where do you find some compromise? How do you expect you may be able to overcome their concerns and yours and be able to keep these vehicles?
Well, obviously, we do wish to operate within a commercial framework. Depending on exactly what the lease provides, that would be the starting point. But we would say to Nissan that if they have concerns about liability or for disposal of the batteries when they are no longer usable, that we'll assume that responsibility. We'll indemnify them from the losses that they might otherwise incur by reason of any injuries or damage that results from these batteries, so that they could go off and say to their board that they've done an action which is responsible from a fiduciary point of view. Until we know exactly the motivations that they have for asking for these vehicles back and informing us that they intend to destroy them. It's a little hard to be more specific in our strategy, but they have indicated that 5 to 7 years from now, they would certainly be in a position to offer us other electric vehicles. The obvious question is, 5 to 7 years in an economy where things get developed and delivered to the marketplace in weeks and months, and I think automobiles these days are being delivered to the marketplace within 2 years after conception.
Well, the Tesla Motor Company, actually, the initial thought happened 3 years ago. It took them a year to raise the funds, about $60 million, and at that point they started to construct this amazing car. Which
interesting.
It took 2 years to roll the car out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a car that competes with Ferraris and Porsches.
Well, I did see a news report on that in recent days. It's not a people's wagon. As I recall, the purchase price was in the range of $80,000 or $85,000.
That's exactly right. But you got to start somewhere.
Exactly right. No, that obviously was a very high performance vehicle with a tremendous style, attractiveness in that regard as well.
And their mission is to make this convert this into a people wagon in a number of years. But making the point that you're making actually is that it shouldn't take that long. So then this kind of begs the question. I mean, it seems as if you make a reasonable counter proposal that we will indemnify you and resolve you from your concern, that you should be able, I mean, in any sort of normal business dialogue, that should seem reasonable. But the sad part is the fact that if you aren't able to come to terms, then they're going to take these cars and destroy them. And I guess from my perspective, I wonder, why are they doing this?
Exactly right. And you know, what kind of pressures, not of a business nature, but, well, in the business context, maybe from, their major stake in an industry that has been governed by the internal combustion engine, what kind of pressures they feel or are receiving from other players in that complex of economic interests to not exploit. To fail to exploit the potential of this new technology.
You know, I really try to be fair. I'm not an anti-corporate person. I'm very much involved in corporate things. But we're reaching a point where you kind of say, what is this strange war that's happening between certain forces within the corporate world and people? Whole communities, including at this point, it has to do with America and our, the United States. Something isn't making sense here, because if we continue down this path of total reliance on oil, we are absolutely cutting our own throats, potentially. Look at what's happening with BP. Look what's happening in the Middle East here. Not only that, but as well, the issue of greenhouse gases. The sooner that we can become energy independent and transform, what in the world is going on between the global corporations and people like yourself and your community and me and my friends?
Well, the world is increasingly complex and uncertain and fast-changing. There's no doubt in my mind that all of the opportunities to do things sensibly, not only economically but environmentally efficiently, need to be explored, because we don't really know what the outer perimeters are of our resources in the world. And to me, a diversified program for mobility, for vehicles, is so logical that we should be turning the world upside down to achieve that situation.
Well, you know, it costs a lot to run a city, part of that being just your fleet. How many vehicles do you have in your fleet?
Frankly, I don't have a correct number in mind, but I can assure you there are several hundred vehicles that are used by our Public Works Department, by our municipal utility, which serves, some 55,000 customers in the city, and all of the other staff persons who run around to service sidewalks and sewers and other municipal amenities around this community. There are hundreds of vehicles, and we have made a commitment to experiment with new technologies in this regard so that we can become knowledgeable, and we can become a positive force in the right direction.
How is the increase in energy, specifically fuel, affecting the city's coffers?
The city is probably in a better position to deal with these petroleum costs, gasoline cost increases of the last year or so more successfully and with less pain than many small business operators who find that the cost of gasoline is a major factor. But obviously, to the extent that we spend money for gasoline because of these incredibly high prices as compared with historical prices for the product, that means that we have less resources available to provide other important services to our community.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's municipalities like Pasadena that can take on these experiments with in cooperation and partnership with the Nissans and the Toyotas and Fords. You have big coffers and lots of people, and you're required to drive. And I don't know, it's a nice partnership. It truly is.
Well, thank you. I think it's true that in addition to having an enterprise of some size and talented people and the finances needed to keep them operating, we have a constituency out there that expects us to do thoughtful things, to use resources well, and to advance the cause not only of individuals but of the community and of society as we face new situations.
Well, let's get back to drama and excitement now. So what do you expect may be happening in the next days, weeks, months?
Whether there will be any dramatic events relating to these vehicles in that time frame, I don't know. Maybe we'll just continue to hold them and make certain that they're not released. And then it's my hope that with the help of Plug-in America, we'll formulate a position both for dealing with the general public and with Nissan to convey, and we will do that perhaps directly with Nissan in the first instance to see what their reaction is, and then as necessary or appropriate and helpful, we'll speak more broadly to the community about the values and the concerns that we're trying to address.
We're talking with Mayor Bill Bolgard of Pasadena. You know, with all the press that this is going to receive, I can expect that you're going to find people showing up in the city. I do think that people have a right to stand up and protect ourselves, our future. What we're talking about here is I actually think it's not only a right, but at this point it's almost a responsibility for us to take a stand for sustainability, energy security, and economic security. And this is only going to happen when we start making real, proper, right decisions. And sometimes it does take a little bit of a standoff. I just have every reason to believe that people will probably end up coming to Pasadena and showing their support.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true. If we find ourselves in need of that support, I could not be more proud if Pasadena ends up serving as not only the catalyst for retaining these vehicles for our own local use, but also for activating other communities and other people to think in positive terms about these new technologies.
That's actually a very bold stand for a public official. I take my hats off to you. Well, good luck. We'll keep informed. I hope we can have a chat again here. And personally, I hope you get to keep those vehicles.
Thank you very
much. Because they serve your city and offer an alternative, actually a mainstream alternative, which is what we absolutely have to have. Hold out for what's right.
Very good. I thank you for your interest, Sydney, and would be delighted to talk with you soon again.
Thanks so much.
Very good.
Good old democracy may still have a chance. We just need a lot more Mayor Bolgards across the country to speak up for America's real future. Good luck, Pasadena. America is on your side. Well, it's time we sidle on up north to Alaska to find out about one of the most legendary tough guys of the tundra. While you wait for the Wild Side News to return, I want you to write down 10 things you know about wolverines. We'll be right back.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Take the ferocity of a grizzly bear, the cunning of a wolf, the speed of a weasel, and the elusiveness of a cougar. Stuff it all in a compact, tough little package, and sprinkle a few here and there in the wild places, and you'd have a pretty good description of one of America's most reclusive and mysterious creatures, the Wolverine. Most everyone knows you'd best watch out for the Wolverines, that is, if you can find one. And if you can, take the time to take a closer look. We do when your Voice of the Earth returns. Get ready. We're heading on up to the wilds of Alaska, where some of America's grandest wild creatures still roam free. Researchers spend lifetimes tracking caribou, grizzly, bears, sea otters, and eagles. But one animal remains an enigma to most of the world. But not to our guest, who I have come to think of as the Jane Goodall of the wild wolverines. Today we're going to take a closer look at an animal that has intrigued me from the time I was very small. I think perhaps my first real fascination began, I think, with a movie by Disney where there was this strange creature portrayed as a very aggressive, mean-spirited animal. It's the Wolverine. One of the interesting things about Wolverines is the fact that so very few people know much about them for a lot of different reasons. We're going to discuss that today with one of the nation's leading Wolverine experts, Dr. Audrey McGowan, who is talking with us now from Alaska. She's one of the co-directors of the Wolverine Foundation. If you want to know about Wolverines, that's where you go. Dr. McGowan, welcome to the Wildside News.
Well, glad to be here.
Wolverines are a fascinating animal, and you self-admit that it's an amazing passion of yours. Why don't you give us a history on how it is that you became so fascinated with Wolverines?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and it's one of those things where you almost can't even remember how it started. It's just as if it's always kind of been there. But in 1978, I had the opportunity to actually do some research on wolverines in northwestern Alaska as part of a study that was being carried out in an area where they were thinking about exploring and developing oil again up in northwestern Alaska called the National Petroleum Reserve. And they were interested in studying a number of species in the area, and wolverines was one of them, and I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to get that chance to study them, and that it all took off from there.
Looking at 30 years' worth of exposure to these animals and their habits, that makes you a very unique person.
Well, there's not very many of us actually that spend a lot of time studying wolverines, but fortunately that number is growing and the interest in wolverines has really grown in the last 5 to 10 years.
One of the unusual things about wolverines is the fact that there is so very little that is really known. The way that most people are exposed is that they're the name of some sort of a sports team. There's probably 500 wolverine sports teams in the United States alone. But what is it about the wolverine that makes it so elusive and therefore difficult to study?
Well, it tends to be an animal that lives in very remote areas, places that people don't ordinarily get to or at least haven't gotten to until recent years. So it'd be high, remote mountain areas, Arctic tundra areas, and the far northern boreal forest, just places where people don't spend very much time. And so they're not very familiar with the animal. They've never seen one, and they've never seen the behavior of one. And so it just doesn't have a place in their minds. But you talk to people who do spend time in those areas, like trappers, for example, in the northern country, And they're quite familiar with the animal, and it sort of has just incorporated into their normal lifestyle. So I think it's just the remoteness of the animal that keeps people from knowing it very well.
I have to admit, I don't think I've ever seen a wolverine, although I've lived in areas where they would have existed. Tell us a little bit about the population. If you go into an area, let's say in Alaska, how many wolverines per acre or per square mile, or what is your criteria for discussing their population?
Well, it's a hard animal to get numbers on. It's not something that you can just go out and count. It's really difficult. Usually, the way scientists try to get some handle on how many there are is by looking at their tracks, and that's a difficult thing to extrapolate from tracks to how many animals are actually there. But there's a few people that have been working on methods, and we use radio telemetry for most studies on wolverines because it's one of the only ways to actually keep track of the animal. And you pull all that information together, and where wolverines are common, which is always a low number even when they're common, we find that you might have reproducing adult females at around maybe 1 per 500 square kilometers. I always have to think of things in square kilometers because that's the way we write our research papers. So, and males are usually, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 times that size, resident males. And then you have your subadult animals, which are just roaming all over the place. And that's where the wolverine gets its reputation for traveling over long distances. It's usually these sort of teenagers and young adults that are just roaming all over the country, and they can be pretty widespread. But wolverines are just locally abundant. They have to have just the right habitat to reproduce and raise their kits, which we call young. And so their distribution in Alaska and other areas where they occur are widespread, but their density is very low in most cases.
This is what I would call the king of the weasels.
Right.
It's a large animal. It's a weasel. It's a member of the weasel family. And therefore, why don't you help us understand what that means, being the largest weasel in North America and perhaps in the world as well?
Well, it's probably the largest weasel, except otters also belong to that Mustelid family, and the sea otter actually is larger.
There you go.
But for the terrestrial weasels, yes, it's the largest one. And the next largest would probably be the fisher. It doesn't have the same lifestyle as a wolverine. A wolverine's mainly a scavenger, but it can actually kill animals as large as caribou, and even moose on occasion have been killed by wolverines. And fishers, you'd never, have them taking down something that large. But so, wolverines are just about at the top and are actually more of a predator than people realize.
That surprised me when I really have done some research on this. They're, about 30-some to 40 inches? Is that head to tail?
Yeah, I would guess that's about. I think of them usually in terms of weight, and you have males that weigh 30 to 45 pounds, and females that are down around 15 to 25 pounds. So, talking about a male wolverine, it's 40 pounds would be a good-sized male wolverine.
And that surprises me that they certainly are a stalking animal and a predator. And when you start looking at the animals that they can take down, that, of course, has to lead to part of its legend of being such a fierce animal. The concept of a wolverine taking down a caribou or an elk, what's their process of hunting?
Well, we can only guess at that because so far I've talked to people that have seen the hunt in progress but have never seen it actually end, and so I'm not sure exactly. I think it may differ from situation to situation. I have talked to someone that's watched wolverines attack wild reindeer in Scandinavia, and I think the critical factor in how they're able to do it is to just be persistent until they pretty much wear the animal out and then begin attacking it. And there is evidence that they actually leap up onto the back of caribou, a reindeer, and and hang on and bite at the back of the neck, but we also have some evidence that they come from the ground up at the throat of the animal. But basically what they do is just keep at it until the animal is just completely exhausted. They don't have the ability to actually kill them like a pack of wolves or even a couple of wolves. They're not that heavy and strong to do that. So persistence is the key. It's a rare thing, you know, to do that. I don't think too many wolverines take the opportunity to unless they're really hungry, because they are basically built for being a scavenger.
That's primarily how they get most of their food.
Right. They're not really built like a prime predator would be. They're built more for, and, you know, and being a weasel, they have, you know, part of that evolution of not having developed into, you know, a predator. They're more, you know, big game. They're more of small mammal predator like most of the other weasels and similar-sized animals are.
I understand that they get a lot of their food from scavenging off of animals that others have killed.
Right.
Then they also have a reputation for being, when they claim some animal as their own, that's when you really have to start waking up and paying attention, because that's when they get very aggressive.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think their reputation for aggression has really been blown way out of proportion, too. You know, a wolverine who depends on finding carcasses, scavenging on carcasses, you know, its whole life depends on being able to hold on to that once he finds it and not share it. And the prime way he does that is to take the carcass apart and hide it, put it in places that the other scavengers and animals can't get at, which is usually under snow, in snow tunnels, under trees where the snow is covered up, fallen trees way back in there, or rock crevices and caves and that sort of thing, so that the other animals can't get to it. But it's worth his while if, while he's at a carcass doing this and some other bigger animal comes along, to at least try to act like he's big and tough and intimidate the other animal, because they're not going to take on a fight with a wolverine if they aren't particularly hungry either. And so some of those animals will back off. But basically, it's a bluffing game, and most wolverines, when pushed to the shove, will back off and leave, because they really can't, you know, defend against something that's larger than them and really wants that carcass.
Okay.
The bluff is everything with a wolverine. But I actually once snuck up on an adult male wolverine that was busy trying to chew a frozen ground squirrel out of the tundra. This is in the wintertime, And he was about, had half of his body down in this snow hole. There was a squirrel that was frozen in there from the previous fall, and he was gnawing on it. So, and it was windy, so he didn't hear me coming up. And I initially thought he was dead, because the wind was blowing snow into his fur, and he was sort of covered up with snow. But as I got closer, I could see his muscles twitching, and I realized he was just down there eating something. And I got within about 4 inches of him and bending down towards him, and it just all of a sudden just popped up out of that hole and gave this kind of ferocious huffing sound and then just ran off as fast as he could go. So, I mean, he had all the opportunity to be ferocious if he wanted to, but it basically sort of just gave a little warning sound and then ran.
This is almost sad to take them off their throne of ferocity.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think people want to take them down off of that throne. I think they'd like their miss, and that will probably perpetuate for a long time, despite what, you know, the truth may actually be.
Well, you've spent almost 30 years working with wolverines. Give us a sense of what it is that has surprised you or that you found most fascinating about these animals.
Well, some of the myths that, you know, that we're talking about that are now at least less strong in my mind than they used to be, the ferocity one. For example, I raised a couple of wolverine babies at one point, and I had them here at the house while they were really tiny, and then I took them out into the mountains to raise them, to watch their behavior and get to know them as an animal, what kind of behavior, how they approach life. Just because people are so unfamiliar with them, you don't really have a sense of what they are. And I remember when they were really little, still being bottle fed, still crawling around, having some friends come over, and these are trained biologists. And one of the comments of one of them when I was holding one of these little fur balls in my lap was, oh, my gosh, I thought they would be really ferocious. And here he's talking about this tiny little bundle of fur that can hardly move around. But our impression of wolverines are of this ferocity, and it's so ingrained that we even expected a tiny little infant to be growling and as it moved around. And what I found instead is that they are every bit as affectionate and intelligent as say, a wolf pup would be or a kitten would be. And I think that was a kind of a surprising thing.
How does a wolverine kit show its affection?
The really unique thing, the really astonishing thing to me is that they stay affectionate. If they know you well, they stay affectionate. It isn't like, when, and I've just heard about raccoons because I've actually never spent any time around raccoons. I've heard about them getting dangerous as they get older.
That's almost a universal. After about 2 years, you just cannot live with them.
And it's just totally untrue about wolverines. As a matter of fact, it's more true about otters, from what I understand with people who've had otters. The wolverines I raised, they had to be returned to captivity. They couldn't be released in the wild. They came from a captive facility, and they had to be returned there according to the permit I had. And I go back 2 or 3 times a year to see them, and they recognize me immediately and still come over and jump into my lap and do this little chuckling greeting noise that they use with each other. And it's obvious that they're very pleased to see me again. I can still put my hand in their mouth, open it up, check their teeth, give them their, you know, inoculations without having to drug them and put them under or anything. They're just so much more, they remember you so much better than you would expect other animals to, I guess. But that was a real surprise to me.
That is fascinating. That it truly is, that they would have that kind of, I would never have expected that from a wolverine.
No, and even I didn't expect it, and I've been around them probably more than you have, and it was a surprise to me that they have that memory, and not only the memory, but the appreciation that you're still around, that you've come back, and they're very interested in coming up and greeting you. And that'll last for a little while, and then they'll go, you know, about their way, doing their normal stuff, and then come back and see you again. But they obviously remember you and obviously are pleased that you're there, because it's a sound that they don't use unless they're being social with another wolverine.
People who've spent time with wolverines tend to say that they seem to be very intelligent and have the capacity to be almost creative in problem solving. They're reaching solutions to their problems. What has been your experience?
Well, I definitely agree with that. You know, they definitely seem to, it's sort of like, you know, ravens, you know, that ravens have a reputation of being smart and being able to solve problems. And that's just the way wolverines are. And perhaps that comes from being mainly a scavenger, and that you have to be very creative in how you go about finding, locating, keeping, holding on to those kinds of sources of food. But they don't seem to waste a lot of time trying something over and over and over again if it doesn't work. You know, they seem to always try to figure out another way to do it, but they don't give up. They're very persistent and trying to get what they want, and they'll try all kinds of things to get it.
So have you had a chance to watch family interactions?
Oh, yeah. In the same facility where the two kits are that I raised, there are other wolverines there that do have young every year. And so I've watched the mothers, you know, raise their babies, and actually have even had males in those compounds after the babies are about 3-4 months old, the adult male's been put back in there, and so there's has been an opportunity to watch those kind of interactions. It's as anyone would expect. A mother, you know, really is into her young and defends her young and spends time with their young. This particular mother that I'm thinking of doesn't spend a lot of time playing with her young, but she's very protective of them.
Now, do the young play like typical small
animals?
Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They're always busy running, chasing, climbing, jumping on each other, wrestling. You know, they spend a lot of time wrestling with each other, just as little puppies or kittens would.
I know so little about wolverines in reality, that, and there's so little that is known, it's hard to know. Even some of the females will mate with any number of males in a season. Is that right or is that wrong?
Well, you know, that's a hard thing to tell in the wild. We do know that in captivity, given, well, they're hard to breed in captivity, number one, and it seems to be that, you know, they're selective about who they mate with, and you can't just put any two wolverines together and expect them to breed. They are selective about their mates. We have had females in captivity breed with multiple different males, but we don't know if that happens in the wild, because the situation in the wild is usually one male sort of patrols a territory that includes the home ranges of several adult females, and he may breed with all of those and attempt to keep other males from breeding. And until we have more DNA studies done on them, we really won't know how that works. But we're assuming right now that it works often like information we have on grizzly bears, where you may have only a few males in the population that do most of the fathering of the offspring from that area.
What is the status of wolverines now in different parts of the, we'll say, our continent here, or nation, Canada, Alaska, North America?
Well, they're still doing well in Alaska and most parts of Canada where they've always been. The one difference there is they used to be in Labrador and Quebec, and for some reason they have not been seen in Labrador and Quebec now for many years, and they haven't been picked up by trappers who are operating there, which is unusual. If they're around, usually they will accidentally get caught, even if you don't have a season on wolverines. And so people are kind of intrigued by exactly why they disappeared. There was a very large decline in caribou in Quebec and Labrador back just before the turn of the century, and that seemed to go along with the disappearance of wolves and wolverines. But the caribou are back, you know, in a million animals now, and wolves are back. The wolverines haven't shown up like they used to be. They were never real abundant there because there isn't the ability, I think, probably to raise young because of the number of small mammals in the summer to hunt and that sort of thing. But they haven't come back again, and we don't exactly know why, and we're trying to find out. In the lower 48 states, they're in many of the places they used to be, except for the Sierra Nevadas in California. And in Colorado, there used to be breeding populations that no longer seem to be there from what we know so far.
Hmm. Well, now you're associated with the Wolverine Foundation, wolverinefoundation.org?
Right.
It's a gathering place of many of the wolverine researchers. Talk about what you folks are working on.
Right. Well, our basic mission is to educate people about wolverines, to provide information about them, and to try to improve basic knowledge about them, and then also to encourage more research on wolverines so that we can learn more about it. So we, although we don't have funding to actually provide to other researchers, what we do provide is a nonprofit organization that can take in funds from those who want to donate money for wolverine research, and then we arrange for the researchers to be able to use that money for different projects that they're working on. And we also sponsored, along with several other organizations, the first international wolverine symposium that was held in Sweden last June, and not this past June, but the year before that. And that was really an interesting meeting. We had wolverine researchers and people interested in wolverines and wolverine conservation from all over the world, Russia, China, Scandinavia, United States, Canada. And it was really a wonderful opportunity to get all these different minds together talking about wolverines and conservation issues and research.
Now, does that legend about the wolverine being this aggressive, fierce animal, Does that exist pretty much throughout its entire range around the world? When you get a chance to talk with all these different people, I'm just curious what they're talking about when they think of world
wounds. Right. It has that reputation, but it also has different problems. Like in Scandinavia, most of the reindeer in Scandinavia are semi-domesticated, so they're herded out in the mountains, out in the wilds by Sami reindeer herders. And in Norway, they have thousands, tens of thousands of domestic sheep that are left to free range in the mountains in the summertime. So over there, although there's a lot of respect for the wolverine, it also kills a lot of what these are essentially domestic animals. And so there's problems with wolverines there that we don't see in the U.S. It's that sort of predation on their livestock is not a problem here. And in Russia, it's still viewed as a big fur-bearing animal, something that is part of the economy. But that reputation that they have here is true all around the world. You know, they're thought of as being a very ferocious, solitary animal, which, again, is something we're finding is not really true about wolverines. They spend a lot of time alone, but they're a very social animal. They will get together and meet up with each other. I've seen a mother meet up with her 2-year-old daughter and play with her. We're finding out now that the males, for example, will be found at dens. We don't know if they're in there with the kits or if they're just hanging around, but they're there, and they're not killing the kits, so we're wondering if maybe there is some social function to the adult males that we don't know about that's happening in the wild. So, you know, so far the reputation is the same around the world, but as the research begins to come in, I think it's slowly changing in those places as well. And in Scandinavia, it's considered one of the big four mega fauna species over there, the charismatic four, and the wolverine is one of them, which it hasn't quite attained that status in the U.S. yet now, because it isn't involved so much in lives of people like it is in Scandinavia.
Mm. Well, there's a lot left to be learned about the wolverines, and we've had an opportunity to take a look at least the legend and then a little bit more at the sensitive side of this elusive creature, the wolverine. Dr. Audrey McGowan, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure, and just glad to let people know more about wolverines.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Personally, the legend remains intact. And I hope one day that a wild wolverine and I may manage to cross paths. But in Alaska, those paths were handed a renewed threat from potential oil spills from the Grand Pipeline. What's the word coming down on the shutdown? That's coming up. Don't go away.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Prudhoe Bay oil fields and Trans-Alaska Pipeline have caused an average of 504 spills annually on the North Slope since 1996. There were 4,532 spills between 1996 and 2004, totaling more than 1.9 million gallons of toxic substances, including diesel, crude oil, and hydraulic oil. It was just in March of 2006 that Alaska's North Slope witnessed the largest oil leak in its history. So says the Wilderness Society. And when you return, you'll hear what other environmental spokespeople have to say about BP, oil, and America's future. It's what you come to hear on the Wild Side News. It came as a shock when that global energy goliath, British Petroleum, the Green Company with the Green Daisy for its logo, shut off access to what is supposed to be our oil, representing fully 8% of our daily oil supply. Many are shocked that this happened without any warning. But I guess it depends on who you listen to. We listened to two views from the Alaska Wilderness League and the North Alaska Environmental Center, who have been challenging BP's promises and claims with each new spill.
This is Pamela A. Miller, and I'm with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. We're up in Fairbanks, Alaska. For years, there's been chronic problems with leaks and spills and news about the corroded pipelines on the North Slope, as well as the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And so this problem in Prudhoe Bay should have come to no surprise by BP or the state. There was a spill in March, the largest spill of crude oil in the Prudhoe Bay oil fields to date. It was roughly 250,000 gallons of oil, and that spill was caused by corrosion. Every year, there's over 500 spills in the oil fields of 40 different toxic substances, including crude oil. Many of those spills are due to corrosion. Back in 1999, when BP bought the oil company ARCO in a huge merger, corrosion was one of the issues that the public raised, as well as the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. So this has been a long-standing problem. So that it's come to this situation of the action that BP took this week is rather perplexing. That it got to this situation. What this tells me today is that the oil companies that are the operators, BP and ConocoPhillips, and Exxon is also a partner in the operation of the oil fields, that they haven't been doing their job in terms of keeping a safe and environmentally sound oil field, and that they can't be trusted to go into new places like they're talking about now, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, our nation's coasts, and other sensitive places in the Arctic, like there's a special place called Teshupuk Lake that a new leasing program has proposed.
So the question that I wonder is, why now, all of a sudden? It couldn't have come at a worse time. And is that part of why it's becoming such an issue?
First, it could have come at a worse time. It could have come in the dead of winter, because experts like Amory Lovins and even former CIA Director James Woolsey have pointed out the strategic vulnerability of the whole Trans-Alaska pipeline system. You know, we have one pipeline from the North Slope coming down across the state of Alaska, and that's where the oil gets shipped on to tankers, and, you know, where the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened at that point back in 89. If it happened in winter, this oil sitting in the pipeline could congeal like, as Amory Lovins puts it, the world's longest chapstick. That said, that's the question everybody is asking, is why did it get to the point that BP felt, you know, took action of saying they were going to shut down the whole oil field instead of fixing these problems in a regular basis? That's a question for BP.
Well, that's the question I'm asking, too. It was a decision on their part because, quite honestly, you know, over the years, they're supposed to be somehow conducting maintenance, regular maintenance, to prevent exactly this kind of thing. And that was the promise that was provided to justify this Trans-Alaskan pipeline.
BP and other oil companies have made promise after promise over the years that defies what their actual practices are. you know, oil is a dirty business. There will be leaks and spills and risks, you know, huge oil spills at various points in the system. You know, you can't have oil development in a wilderness like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Over the years in the oil field, the workers have been the ones who have spoken up and through the press brought out their concerns about how vulnerable the pipeline is. Back in 2001, Wall Street Journal had a major article about the problems that were happening there. That was after BP had bought out ARCO and you had the entire Prudhoe Bay field run by one company instead of two. Less competition, less oversight up on the slope. But the other thing that happened is you had administrations, both federal and state, with our Governor Murkowski, who were not enforcing and weren't monitoring. They've cut staff in the regulatory agencies to less than bare bones. We've had conflict of interest in the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Organization, which is our state agency that maintains the safety of the pipeline. The administration simply has not done its regulatory job. And we had the spill in March. The state government could have imposed fines on BP. We've seen nothing since March in terms of that action. We do know that the EPA and the Department of Transportation, you know, there is a criminal investigation going on with respect to the March spill, and that investigation may have been what, because the federal agency required this pigging of the pipeline, which is an internal inspection of what really is the situation, we are finally learning on the outside how bad it is. But the workers were telling BP management and the media for many years that there's very big problems at Prudhoe Bay.
Right. The spill in March was pretty much kept under the ice, so to speak, until it was forced into the public's arena.
Right. The spill in March was interesting because there was a very big delay of informing people how big the spill really was.
That's exactly right.
So that they could get the pools of oil pretty well cleaned up by the time the major media got up there.
Well, what I'm wondering is, was there actually a spill event that, a significant spill event that now forced this decision by BP to shut this down, or was this more or less a preventative? Is it more preventative on the part of BP to protect itself against further litigation? There was a spill, but it wasn't of any grand consequence. Am I right about that?
The spill was discovered as they were inspecting the pipe. I think the big change that I see from what had, you know, from kind of the normal operations where nobody was really looking over their shoulder at all, even in the face of major spills. With the March spill, it was a pipeline regulated by the state. Due to a number of loopholes in the regulations, it could have been regulated by the federal government. And the federal government did become involved due to issues that had been raised about the operation of that pipeline. So they required this further inspection of a certain class of pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
It's something like 22 miles of pipeline. On the slope, there's 1,600 miles of pipes in 450 miles of corridors, most of which are only regulated by the state of Alaska. The federal government doesn't have the same handle on all those other pipes, and there's a lot of questions on those as well. But this pipe, where the spill occurred in March, feeds into the very big sales pipeline that then goes directly into Pump Station 1 of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The wall of that pipe they found in that inspection had lost 80% of its steel due to corrosion. And we have a state legislator who said, I think it's Representative John Harris said, we don't want another Exxon Valdez. So there were risks in this system of very dangerous to humans as well as to the environment situation up there, apparently. That's what I can garner out of the news.
My take on this is that it's not going to help the cause for expanding oil exploration into Teshikpuk Lake. And this almost could be considered sort of a Katrina event in the sense that it's a wake-up call that these things are that these systems are falling apart, and that, quite honestly, the promises and that we keep hearing about really don't carry much weight.
This is a wake-up call that the claims of BP, Exxon, and the other companies seeking to drill in the world's most sensitive places, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and Teshikpuk Lake, are hollow, and that they don't have their affairs in order in terms of conducting safe and clean operation, and that they have such power over our state and federal governments right now in terms of political influence that the regulators aren't doing their job. So between the political situation, the sheer economic power, and their priorities of making huge profits but not investing them into doing the very things that they claim they're doing has led us to this situation today.
I'm just curious what you're hearing in terms of the time frame for these repairs to be made. We're hearing anything from a month to a couple of months, and what are you hearing today? Because it changes every day.
It will change every day. That is anybody's guess, and that's the kind of question only BP can answer.
Now, does some of this pipeline that may have to be repaired run over? I know typically they do a lot of their work in the winter because the ground is frozen, and therefore the roads give them accessibility. Do you know if that's going to pose a problem in terms of their efforts to deal with whatever this problem is that they're shutting down the pipeline for?
The area of pipelines that are involved with the March spill, as well as the pipeline that they identified on Sunday, it's right in the heart of Prudhoe Bay where there's lots of roads. So access isn't an issue. I think personnel, and this is an unprecedented sort of event, and figuring out how they're going to do it, you know, as you have these over 1,000 pipelines from the wells, you know, you have hundreds of well pads, it all feeds into fewer and fewer bigger pipes. Well, this is one of those biggest pipes before it hits the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Gotcha.
The other thing I will mention, though, as part of the timing, our legislature is in special session over the issue of oil and gas taxes and a contract that the Governor Murkowski negotiated in secret with the three big oil companies over a gas pipeline to bring existing known gas from Prudhoe Bay down to the lower 48. And that pipeline negotiations is at its hilt. It's at the peak. And the regulators, you know, whether that's influenced the regulators' ability to do their jobs, clearly it's part of the mix of the politics of very hardball politics up here. And there's many candidates for governor who are not happy with the secret negotiated contract on the gas pipeline. So that is one factor, and it's impossible to tell how exactly it's playing out.
It's hitting us in a very difficult way. But again, I'm going to put a positive spin on this. I think it is indicative of the fact that the promises are as thin-walled as the pipes themselves.
Oh, that's a very good way of saying it.
And that the promises are going to be ruptured in the future as they are and as they have been in the past. And so, therefore, it's time for everyone to question in a much more intensive way the promises, because they just don't hold up. So we'll have to see.
I couldn't have said it better.
You feel
use that idea in the future.
You can always just refer people to the Wild Side News. That's what it's about.
Well, I'm going to be looking a little more deeply into exactly what the state did over the last couple years regarding the corrosion issue, reanalyzing the oil spill database to find out among the causes of spills how corrosion ranks out, because I know it's really high.
We're talking with Pam Miller, who's with the North Alaska Environmental Center, and she's going to keep us informed in the future here. Pam, you're going to call me and let me know what's going on at any point here, right?
Yes, I sure will. We'll have lots of updates from Alaska, and keep watching to keep Alaska on the wild side.
Now, if people want to contact you and your organization, what's the best way for them to do so?
We have a website, www.northern.org, and you can find out information about our organization there, and I'll be posting updates.
Very good. Pam, thanks a lot for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Okay, thanks a lot.
We continue our discussion about the situations developing in Alaska with BP shutting off the oil. And now to give us another perspective is Kristen Miller. She's with the Alaska Wilderness League. Kristen, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
What's your interest, the Alaska Wilderness League, in, first of all, in Alaska and the wilderness?
Well, our mission is to work to protect some of the most important and ecologically significant wild places in Alaska. You know, we work out of D.C. from a legislative perspective, but we work to protect Alaskan wilderness.
You're very familiar with the situation that's developing in terms of BP shutting down the pipeline for
purposes.
Why don't you give us your perspective? What's your take on what's happening there?
It's a very important issue for us. And we're watching it very closely. I think from our perspective, what this is a very salient example of what's going up on Alaska's North Slope. A lot of the areas that we're working to protect are near Prudhoe Bay, where the pipeline was just recently shut down. The fact that BP has chosen to shut these pipelines down does not stem from a very new problem. It's an old problem, and it's a problem that we've been seeing for years that the bottom line is oil drilling up on Alaska's North Slope is a very dirty business. And, you know, as we watch Congress and drilling proponents try to get into new areas, some of the most special areas, we think, in Alaska, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and there's other areas on the western, an area called Chepuk Lake that might, you know, be open for leasing as early as this September, we think this is of great concern because I think we're seeing firsthand how dirty the oil business is up there.
I'm trying to figure this one out because the oil interests are very often clever at creating spin. I don't think this is spin. I think this, because it, from my perspective, and you may be able to give me a different perspective, and I certainly would appreciate that, but it seems as if this really comes at a very bad time for them to have this, to make this decision. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, while they are turning off the pipelines preemptively, this was not something that they had much of a choice in. As you probably know, there was the largest oil spill in the history of North Slope activities just this March. It was it was caused by BP, and it was 200,000 gallons of oil. After that, they came under criminal investigation by the EPA and the Department of Justice, which led to them being required to close down 57 more of their oil wells once they started realizing how much corrosion there was in their pipelines. And throughout this investigation process, they realized that the pipelines that they just chose to preemptively shut down were very unstable. So this was not so much of a PR stunt. It's something that they were forced to do because they're under investigation for their safety practices.
It really makes the case that we are extremely vulnerable in terms of our dependence on oil. And that, as well, it also makes the case that all the promises that have been laid out to justify, for example, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, are fairly thin and vulnerable as well.
Absolutely.
This really puts us in a difficult position. How do you think this is going to affect now some of the traditional pressures to drill in expand drilling in Alaska?
I really hope that, you know, members of Congress who advocate for drilling, you know, take a hard look at what's going on up there, because what they're advocating for, especially with drilling in places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or Chechuk Lake, is giving even more of our special land, our nation's public lands, over to the oil companies at a time when we just can't trust them. I mean, I think if anything we've learned from this incident, we cannot trust that the oil industry is able to ensure that their practices up there are going to be clean. Now, Congress understands that this country needs a new energy future, but unfortunately it seems like all we've been seeing recently is drilling bills, and more drilling bills. And the polls show that that's not what Americans are looking for. Americans are looking for American technological know-how to put us on a new path, to put us on a road to a stronger economy. We can lead the world in the creation of new and clean energy. It's possible, you know, the solutions exist today, and we hopefully that this will be a spark plug and get us down that path.
To some extent, this is an opportunity for people to speak up and hold their feet to the fire and say, look, you know, this is a prime example of why we have to beware. If people want to do that, to speak up and to support your efforts, what's the best way for them to do so?
We have a website. It's www.alaskawild.org. And, you know, you're welcome to go to our website and get more information on any of the issues in Alaska. But, you know, our energy future depends on Congress, and Congress needs to understand that the American public want us to go down a different road. The oil industry is unstable, it's dangerous, and it's very, very messy. But there are solutions so that we don't have to just keep trying to drill our way out of the problem. So I would just encourage people to call their member of Congress, call their senators, and tell them that you want to see, you know, a new CAFE bill and renewable energy and funding for renewable energy and some of the technologies that exist today to put us on a better path to a better energy future.
Well, Kristen, I am 100% behind those thoughts. That's exactly what we need to do. It's something that we should have been doing a long time ago, and this particular incident makes it abundantly clear that, quite honestly, we have no choice.
Absolutely.
This is what we must do. And, you know, the thing that is irritating to me is the fact that it seems as if, to some extent, the oil companies, for the sake of maintaining their profitability, are putting us at risk, putting this country at risk, our future, our economy, our stability,
mm-hmm.
our way of life. And that's absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong. People do matter. And I think maybe Americans are beginning to really wake up to this kind of an emerging new reality that we do matter and we need to take back our power.
I hope so. I hope so. You know, I mean, we always say, and this is the reality, that America uses 25% of the world's oil, and we have 3%. So we can drill in my backyard, in your backyard, at every national park and wildlife refuge, and we're never going to be able to make up that gap. We're always going to be importing at least half of our oil from foreign countries, and that includes rogue nations and, you know, areas that we don't have any control over.
Mm-hmm.
There's no stable future in oil, and we need to change, and we need to make a change now.
This is our moment. Make the most of it.
I hope so. I hope so. And, you know, the energy future is really important to us, but so are these special places that we advocate for. I mean, millions of Americans care about these places so much, and they're so ecologically significant, and there's just an abundance of wildlife up there and so many different types of species that we're trying to protect. You know, and that's part of this country's heritage, too, you know. This is part of who America is, and we have the ability to move forward while maintaining our special places and, you know, having a safe, clean energy future.
We can recreate a vision of America the way it really has been for 100 and some years, and we need to take it back because there's no sense giving up the wonder for some, I don't even know quite what it is, some sense of security, which is obviously very false because the world is not a very secure place right now.
Right.
So the concept of relying on that is the most important thing is false.
Right.
It's just false. So why don't we just simplify things a little bit and use our intelligence and gain real security by securing our energy and economic futures by becoming self-reliant?
Yeah, I mean, there's overwhelming public support for moving away from fossil fuels and towards a different energy future. And I just hope Congress will start reflecting what the majority of Americans already know and believe.
Well, Kristen, at some point we're going to call you back and have another chat about the wonder, okay, of the Alaskan wilderness. Because
oh, absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Actually where I like to play most. Kristen Miller with
yes.
the Alaska Wilderness League, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much.
With each new scuffle between the old guardians of industrial power and the people on the streets, in the neighborhoods, and cities, and countryside, and wild places, it becomes ever more apparent that together we can make a difference. We have truth on our side, and as has been carved into the walls of history, time and time again, the truth shall set you free. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.